Shrink Wrap Radio number 292, The Mother Line, with Jungian analyst Naomi Ruth Lewinsky.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Jungian analyst Dr. Naomi Ruth Lewinsky, and we'll be discussing her book, The Mother Line, which is about the journey to discover the roots of the feminine psyche. It should be of interest not only to our female listeners, but also to those men who wish to understand them. To learn more about Dr. Lewinsky, please consult our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Naomi Ruth Lewinsky, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you.
Well, it's good to have you on the show. I recently interviewed your friend and fellow analyst, Pat Damery, I think it is, about her book.
Yes, Patricia Damery.
Yeah, about her book, Farming Soul. And so let's talk, and I know you two are collaborators. You're working on other things together, right?
We are, yes.
So let's talk about your book, The Mother Line. So first of all, what do you mean by the term mother line?
I understand the mother line to be the interconnection between generations of women. And for men, it's their relationship to their connection to the birth process. I mean, all life begins in a woman's body. And I was struggling with this notion that lineage tended, at least at the time that I was working on this book, which was a while ago, to be seen totally in male terms. And I thought, hey, wait a minute, there's something missing here. So for me, the image of the mother line is kind of like umbilical cords that tie us back to our great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmothers and forward to generations to come. So a woman who has children and who thinks about, will often think about her children in terms of her own memories of being a child. And I call that looping. That's another form of the mother line. And women who don't have children or men, you know, relate to the women who gave them birth.
You know, there was a portion in your book where you were talking about this, and it reminded me of something that my wife had shared with me some years back before we had children, I think. And it was a kind of vision in which she saw these pelvic arches, if you will, extending way into the past and way into the future.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah, and she realized that, you know, that she was in this flow both from the past and from the children that would come. And then since then, we had four children.
Ah.
And, you know, and at least one of them has had some children. Now, you yourself are a daughter and a granddaughter and a mother and maybe a grandmother too, or not?
Oh, yes, a grandmother as well, yes. So, I wasn't at the time that I wrote the book,
yeah,
which was 20 years ago, but now I'm a grandma.
Okay. The book is you wrote 20 years ago?
I did, yes. It's been reissued by Fisher King Press, but it was originally published by Putnam in 1992.
Oh, well, I had no idea. I hope you can, as I ask you questions about the book, I hope you can remember. Maybe some of your ideas will have changed because I just looked at the copyright date and it was like 2010.
Yeah.
If I had read the fine print further down on the page, maybe I would have seen something indicating that it was older than that.
Well, it's my first publication, and women still come and tell me how much it means to them and are, you know, buying it currently, which makes me really happy. And I was very delighted when Fisher King Press decided to reissue it.
Well, this adds particular relevance to the next question that I had here, which was in your foreword, you say you've been working on this book all your life.
Right.
And so how so was the question. Tell us about what you meant when you said that 20 years ago.
Well,
or maybe it's a new, maybe the foreword was for this edition.
No, actually, I had been, I think I said that at the time that I originally published it because I became a mother very young, and I married young and had children very young. And as I developed and had some Jungian analysis and began to reflect on myself, I came to understand that I needed to have babies young because my people were German and Russian Jews who had to flee from Hitler. And so many were lost in the Shoah, in the Holocaust, that at an unconscious level, I just needed to repopulate the earth. Of course, I obviously wasn't going to do that single-handedly, but it was there was this enormous inner pressure to have children.
How old were you? You say you were very young. How old were you?
I was married at 18 and had my first child at 19.
Okay.
That's pretty young, huh?
Yeah, By middle class U.S. standards, that's true.
Mm-hmm. Right, that's true. That was such a giving birth was such a powerful experience, it's an archetypal experience, of course. And one of the great things, at least for me, about having a baby young was it was pretty easy to give birth, you know. So I was able to really, really enjoy the experience and didn't have to use any drugs, and felt like I was transformed by that experience. And I kept feeling I needed to be able to write about it. But, you know, I had kids to take care of and dishes to do and meals to prepare and a husband going to medical school, so it really wasn't a good time. But I kept thinking about it and I kept making little stabs at it.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I got older and my kids got older, I started getting really angry that I could not put being a mother on a resume. And so I began plotting how I could put this on a resume.
Right.
So when I decided to go get my master's degree in psychology, and because I wanted to work as a therapist, I did a dissertation about three generations of women and how ideas about contraception had changed. And then when I decided, after I'd been in practice for a while, that I wanted a doctorate, I did a dissertation again about women and interviewed women about their experiences. And that's where the mother line idea really came into focus for me. When a woman whom I interviewed began talking about her daughter's first menstruation and how moved she was by it, and kind of like your wife's image, she suddenly started describing this as being the bridge between generations, that she could see herself and all the women before her, and then all the women from her daughter on going on into the future in this moment of seeing the blood on her daughter's underpants. You know, it was so moving. And I began thinking about that in terms of Jung's beautiful essay on the Eleusinian Mysteries, where he talks about the interconnection between generations of women as having this kind of healthy aspect for women, where they kind of know who they belong to and they know where they're going. And that was at a time when women's lives were pretty circular, and women, I don't know if they were happy with it or not, I don't go back that far, but you know, there was that sense of becoming your mother and through giving birth and having a daughter, remembering your younger self. That is something that I think is enormously valuable that had, certainly at the time that I was working on the book with the feminist movement, which was extremely important for my development, but there was this kind of rejection of the feminine and the Jungian sense of the feminine by a lot of feminists.
Yes. You know, I want to pick up on both of those things that you just mentioned, but first I wanted to ask you, early on you write, and I'm going to quote, "We're so full of judgments about what mother ought to be that we can barely see what mother is." So tell us about that.
Well, you know, you and I are in a profession that tends to objectify mothers. In fact, mothers are the essential objects, you know. Object relations is all about the relationship to the mother. And so much is understood about our psychological development in terms of our relationship to our mothers at a very young age. And of course, I think that's profoundly true and very, very important. But there's been a kind of bias which identifies with the child's point of view and doesn't see the mother's point of view that has left mothers out of the equation.
Mm-hmm.
And so to think about the mother and her experience and her reality is part of the psychological picture that I think is a great loss if we don't include that. And it's a great loss to women who are mothers because we can't basically identify with ourselves because we keep thinking, and you know, in my practice, I'm constantly hearing this from women. Oh my God, I'm ruining my child. You know, I did this, I did that. There's this hyper-consciousness and self-criticality about being a human being who has limitations and has a temper sometimes, you know, and has needs.
Right. So yes, you did talk about the, about psychology having a long history of being child focused. And you mentioned feminism, and it was clear that you were impacted by the feminist movement. What do you see as the pluses and the minuses of the feminine perspective on the feminine? The feminist perspective.
Well,
say that 10 times real fast.
Right, exactly. Well, for me, I was trapped in a very conventional notion as a young woman of what my role was to be, and a marriage to a very nice person who just was not somebody that I had much in common with. You know, I married young out of this kind of biological or psychological cultural need to have babies is how I see it now. So there was a moment, and I think a lot of it had to do with feminism, where in a consciousness-raising group of young women in the 70s, I suddenly got it that I didn't belong where I was, that I had a lot of needs to be a creative person, to be an exploratory person, and there wasn't really room for that in my relationship. And so, like lots of people did in the early 70s, I left that marriage and went out and explored the world, you know, with my three young kids in tow.
Wow. That was brave.
Right. And my kids refer to that time as the poverty days, and I'm surprised at how fond they are of those days because I think it was hard, but certainly hard for me. But it was also exciting, and I feel like it freed me to have a sense that I had a right as much as any man I might be with would have a right to find my own personal place in life, not to just be a bearer of life, but to have a creative connection to myself in relationship to life. And that's enormously important.
Yes. So you were empowered, as the popular word goes these days.
That's right, yes.
You were very empowered by the feminist movement. At the same time, as you reflected on it, you felt that the feminist perspective was maybe too daughter-identified. Can you say something about
that? Daughter-identified and in an unconscious way, male-identified. You know, it's kind of like women wanted to be like men. And boy, back in the 70s and 80s, women were writing books about why should women have to do such a nasty task as bear children. Mm-hmm. You know, there wasn't a sense of there was an identification with a male view of the feminine, which is, oh my God, that's disgusting, you know,
right.
Instead of a sense of the beauty and mystery of it. So I feel like we've come a long ways, and there are many more women now who are both feminists and very appreciative of the feminine, and appreciative of the miracle of being able to bear life and of the menstrual cycle. And
there was a very difficult time there to be a male with a lot of angry women on the warpath in the 70s. And
that's really true. Yeah.
I'm lucky to have a number of women friends who are very Jungian in their orientation. And so they, you know, they have both that quality of feeling empowered and fully empowered, but also valuing the feminine.
Right, and valuing the masculine not only within themselves, but in men.
Yes.
I mean, that's incredibly important, and I'm glad you raised that because I think it was very, very hard for men and continues to be.
Yeah, yeah. Another thing that you write, and again I quote, "Because the gods are dead, mothers are expected to stand in for them, taking the blame for much that more truly belongs to fate." Can you reach back and expand on that for us?
Well, you know, luckily I actually agree with myself.
Good. Yeah, what do you mean that mothers stand in for the gods?
Well, I mean, you know, it's like the power that is projected on the mother as this all-powerful, I mean, when you're the mother of a baby, you are standing in for the great mother. Mm-hmm. You know, you're nursing, hopefully, you're responding to the child. But of course, you're not the great mother. You need to sleep. You've got a husband to deal with, maybe. You've got other children, maybe. You know, maybe you have a job. And you can't be, you know, the great mother in that full sense of being a goddess. But because we don't have that kind of sense of the gods carrying a lot of power and we as human beings having limitations, so many of us, particularly the more educated and intelligent among us, have lost that sense of the kind of humility of what we can control and what we can't control. We take way too much responsibility or ascribe too much responsibility to the individual mother. I think that a child's temperament has a lot to do with fate, the birth order, the place that the family is in terms of the capacity of the family to provide for the child, and also what's going on in the culture. I mean, I think of people trying to have, you know, keep the families together in this economy now. It is just awful, and it is not something that we can just do something about, you know?
Yeah.
What, you're caught in something much larger that has to do with fate.
Right. Yeah, boy, the economy. I've been watching a documentary called Inside Job about the whole 2008 crash of the economy. And mm-hmm. boy, talk about fate intervening in just a huge way.
In all of our lives.
Yes, just right across the planet. And that,
yes.
You know, such mischief.
Right.
But
there were some people who had some responsibility, but I don't think you or I are among them.
Yeah, not that I'm aware of. But
right.
Relevant here, I think, is you speak about three levels of looking at the mother-daughter relationship, the personal, the cultural, and the archetypal. So maybe you can kind of take us through each of these.
Yeah, well, you know, what I'm saying about the mother standing in for the goddess is at the archetypal level, mm-hmm. and that's the level that was worshipped in the Eleusinian mystery religions, which were practiced for 5,000 years, and were about the Demeter Persephone myth, in which Persephone is seized by Hades and taken down into the underworld, and her mother is in such deep grief that she makes everything stop growing. And there was a whole religious practice that Jung and Kereny write about very movingly, in which people identified with the goddess and went, I think they took some substances, it's believed they took some substances, and they spent 9 days, you know, getting into a trance and going into a dark place and being blindfolded and getting into a state where they were dealing with the sense of their mortality and their lack of control over their lives. And then, you know, having let themselves down into that deep, dark, archetypal place, they removed the blindfolds, and a priest held up a grain of wheat. And this was this magical moment in which they recognized that the wheat would fall into the earth and be like something dead, but then it would spring up again in the spring and be reborn. And so there is this kind of archetypal sense of death and rebirth that's at the core of Jungian psychology, at the core of so many religions, and carries this profound archetypal sense that the woman whom I interviewed at the beginning of my book, Work on the Mother Line, saw when she saw her daughter's menstrual blood. So you that's know, the archetypal level.
Yeah. You know, I think of Jung as being sort of a feminist in some ways, ahead of his time.
Absolutely. For me, he totally is. I mean, he's a feminist in the feminine sense.
Yeah.
But also, you know, he encouraged so many women to, you know, he was surrounded by the women that people call the Jungfrauen, you know, and they were all brilliant women, Maria Louise von Franz and you know, so many women who were early analysts and who were encouraged by Jung to use their intelligence and their creativity to become themselves.
Even his wife became a Jungian analyst, didn't she?
Yeah, she. Yes, I think she was doing some practice, and she wrote this beautiful book on the Grail.
Yes, right. Now, you mentioned earlier your the doctoral work that you did, and I guess it got integrated into this book as part of your work.
Yes, it all got folded in.
Yeah. You decided to study the lives of other women, and you interviewed 25 women, all of them mothers and some grandmothers. What did you learn in this process? You did tell us the story about the menstruation, but it, sort of pulling back, what is it that you learned about women?
I learned that women have, you know, there's a value in our culture about thinking in a linear way. And I learned that women seem organically to not want to think in a linear way, but then they apologize for it. They say, oh, I'm all over the place. But what they're doing is what I came to think of as looping. I mean, they're talking about themselves, then they're talking about their mothers, then they're talking about their daughters, and then maybe they go back to their mother's mother, and maybe then if their daughter has a daughter, they'll talk about that, you know, and they're back and forth. And I began to see, it looked like, in my mind's eye, it looked like crocheting or knitting. It looked like that kind of interconnection that creates fabric.
Interesting.
And the other thing that I found painful as I became conscious of this was how many of us women start apologizing. And they're really pulling important things together, but because, you know, there's this notion that you're supposed to think a certain way, there was an embarrassment about it. And I felt like that was connected to women's embarrassment about their bodies, about their cycles, and about the issues of giving birth and all the things that are, you know, kind of old wives' tales. And so at a cultural level, you know, I feel like our culture has made it hard to enjoy the complexity and the richness of the natural, organic way in which women think about their lives.
Maybe you can talk about the challenges of the daughter differentiating herself from her mother. I seem to recall from psychodynamic theory that the challenge for the daughter is quite different and more difficult in some ways than for the son.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think the reason it's so much more difficult is because the daughter, at an archetypal level, is like her mother.
Mm-hmm.
So if she's going to differentiate herself, she really has to work hard at it, because the tendency is to kind of be pulled into that ancient archetypal shape of the daughter becoming the mother, having a daughter who becomes the mother. And so in our time, where luckily women have many more things they can do besides becoming a mother, and I think that's really important. A daughter feels she needs to differentiate, and also because she's interested in her own character and her own personality, which may be extremely different than her mother's. I was lucky and had a very wonderful mother, but her personality is totally different than mine. And so, you know, I mean, a small thing is that my mother, her favorite expression is too fancy. She doesn't want anything fancy.
Huh.
Well, I love beautiful clothes. You know? My mother never would go shopping with me. So, you know, this process of being feeling like it's okay for me to be different than my mother, to enjoy clothes, or to prove to myself that I have a different kind of personality than hers was very important. And then, of course, I have a daughter. I have two daughters. One, my biological daughter, is just like my mother. And I could never get her a dress. She wouldn't wear a dress. She wouldn't wear a dress to her own graduation. My adopted daughter is more like me. Go figure, yeah. You know, and she loves beautiful clothes.
Interesting. Yeah, and it seems like in the process of therapy, often the daughter goes through a period of being really angry at her mother as part of that differentiation. It just has all kinds of baggage and anger
right. Directed
at the mother, and then periodically is saying, oh my God, I'm just like my mother, and hating that aspect of herself. But then later, if therapy is successful, somehow comes to terms with and begins to value that internalized part of the mother.
Yeah, I think that that's always a sign to me that, that things are really shifting when a daughter can begin to value her mother, or if she has had a mother who wasn't very competent or who really was a terrible mother, to have compassion for her, because, of course, our mothers all have stories, and they've gone through dreadful things. And, you know, in my story, my mother... family had to leave Germany for the Netherlands when my mother was 13. My mother got pulled away from this whole life that she had known and valued. And suddenly she, you know, was in an upper class German Jewish, very assimilated family. And suddenly she discovered she was a Jew and she was hated by the people that she had thought were her people. So, you know, that was a terrible trauma. And, you know, you could feel it in my mother's personality. And, of course, my grandmother was enormously traumatized by that, too. My grandmother, like so many women of her generation, lost her mother when she was 2. Her mother died in childbirth. So, you know, you go back and you have these very, very wounded mother lines. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of part of the mother line, that there's so much suffering and death and birth in it. And... you know, as women, as their psyches become larger and they are more accepting of their own shadow aspects and parts of themselves that they don't like, they can begin to think about, well, how come my mother's that way? And how come my grandmother was that way? And what was that all about?
Yes. And you talk about a somewhat corresponding father line, but you say, and again I'm quoting, the father line is even more unknown in our culture than the mother line. For while women's mysteries have been segregated and disenfranchised in the patriarchy, men's mysteries have been either sublimated beyond recognition or obliterated. Maybe you can expand on that a bit.
Well, of course, that was before Bly that I wrote that. Yeah. I think Bly was really doing a good job trying to get men conscious of their mysteries. Well, I think, you know, at the archetypal base and the cultural base, one of the big issues here is that men don't necessarily know that the woman they're with is bearing is their child unless they totally control that woman. So controlling that woman so that they know that that's their seed that produced a child that she's giving birth to has been a very important part in culture for thousands and thousands of years, and I think has everything to do with the development of patriarchy.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, men's mysteries are hard to get a hold of because I think men they haven't wanted to feel how basically helpless they are in relation to, you know, women. If women have freedom and women can, you know, sleep with whomever they want and have whosoever child they want, you know, that puts men in a very vulnerable position. I think to know the mysteries, you have to know your vulnerabilities and be open to them.
One of the things that I've sort of discovered in my involvement with the men's movement, I've been in a men's group for probably around 20 years and,
oh, wow,
and read some of the men's books, you know, that were originally inspired by the women's movement.
Right, right.
And in one of the books, and I don't remember which one, he really emphasized how dependent we men are on women, but we're mostly in denial about that much of the time. And maybe as part of that differentiating from the mother process, we just kind of... you know, we have this probably because of our cultural context too, where we're supposed to be big and strong and powerful and protectors and all of that. As men get older, in particular, I think we become a lot more dependent upon wives and the women in our lives and needy. Needy, I'll say it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and I mean, in terms of... the sense of lineage and continuity, men are totally dependent on women, even as young men, if they have children young,
yes,
for that. So I agree with whoever wrote that book that I think that's a big dynamic between men and women. But within within patriarchy, it's looked to women like men had it good. You know, they could just go out and live their lives and do their thing, and women would take care of them. So I think that mothers have tended to prefer boys because they identify with the boys and with the power in the boy, because of that projection, and haven't understood that it comes out of this denied dependency. I actually think that one of the most exciting things that's happened in my lifetime has been that so many men are present at the birth of their children.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that
it has
really
made a difference, hasn't it?
I think it makes a huge difference in terms of connecting men both to the power and vulnerability of women and to their own power to be caretakers and to be companions in that amazing, miraculous, mysterious, dangerous passage.
There was some place in your book where there was a passage where I felt really seen and understood as a man. And
oh, I'm so pleased.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I didn't mark it up, so I haven't been able to find that place again to bring it up here. But I think it's scary to be a man, and somehow I think you recognize that. I mean, women are fearful of men's power, of their physicality, and so on. Well, so are many of us men. You know, if
scared of your own physicality
Of other men.
Oh, of other men. Yeah.
Both the vulnerability of being called upon to go to war, mm-hmm. you know, and all that.
Yes.
Means, but also if a man is out on the street with a woman and another man makes lewd gestures or something, that man is supposed to fight for her honor. That's mm-hmm. that's still in our code of expectations.
Oh, it sure
and so
is.
On.
It's a huge expectation.
You know, so it tends to make the world a bit of a scary place, not only for the woman, but for the man as well.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, and it's a cultural expectation that you know you may not be comfortable with. Maybe you don't want to, you know.
Yeah, really. If you're
using
not,
your
if
fist.
You're not a physical brute, you know.
Right, that's right.
You've got a chapter titled "Wrestling with the Mother." It probably touches on some of the things we were talking about earlier.
Wrestling
with
that
the
differentiation
mother,
process.
Yeah, of love, rebellion, and our personal shadows. We haven't spoken about the shadow here.
Well, I mean, the mother archetype is full of shadow. And, you know, if you think about some of the goddesses we know about, Kali, for example, the Indian goddess is a very dark goddess. She gives birth and then she'll chop your head off. You know?
Yeah.
You see these statues of Kali and she's, you know, she's just given birth and then off comes the head. And of course, what we understand about a culture like India is that so many children died so young that was exactly true. But Kali was the goddess of birth and death and time, you know. So there is that archetypal sense of the goddess representing death as well as birth. She's also the terrible goddess. She brings in, you know, if you think of even our relationship to our own earth, who is getting pretty mad at us these days, it seems to me, and is throwing up a lot of temper tantrums with storms and floods and fires and, you know, she's pretty mad at us for good reason, but still, her terrible aspect is pretty scary, and people are in such denial about it in our culture. I just find it breathtaking.
Yeah. Your book is filled with motherline stories of various women, and you weave the story of your own motherline throughout it. Perhaps you can take us through some of the highlights of your own motherline journey and how motherhood perhaps changed you.
Sure. Well, as I mentioned, I had children young, and I didn't understand this until I was much older, because my people had to flee, and so many of my people were lost in the Holocaust. My mother's parents, you know, were German Jews who had money, and my grandfather was a very good at getting people, a lot of family people, out of Germany and getting his own family, his own immediately family, out as much as he could. My father's side of the family, my father had been born in Germany, but his parents were Russian Jews. That's where the Lewinsky name comes from. And a lot of his people didn't make it out of Germany and out of Holland. And, you know, like his mother and father never made it. They were living in Holland at the time. And I didn't know until after my father's death in 85 when I received the contents of his safety deposit box that he had a letter from his mother who was in a concentration camp in Holland. She was in Westerbork, which was a transit camp, but she died in that transit camp. And she had written a letter to my father, basically kind of telling him that he better take care of his sister, who was her oldest daughter, who was also in the concentration camp with her, that she hoped that he would find a way of getting her back to America. He was very lucky. He had all this, you know, he had money, he had a job, he had family backup on his wife's side. And then she said, she addressed my mother, who was quite a bit younger than my father, and said that she was so sorry that she wasn't going to get to see her development, and she wondered if she might be pregnant. I looked at the date, and that was 9 months before I was born. And then she died just right thereafter.
Wow.
So, you know, I when that happened, I had a real intense experience of her presence, that she knew in some way, my paternal grandmother, that that I was on the way, and that there was a connection between her and me that I needed to honor.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that's happened in my writing over the years, and it began with the mother line, is that I had to write about her. And in the mother line, I quoted that her letter, which the letter ended as a blessing to the family and the people that would come after her death, and a plea that we not take her dying in such a terrible way as a reason not to fully live our lives. I mean, this was a psychologically sophisticated woman who had a sense of the kind of survivor guilt that might keep people from being able to fully engage with their lives because of what had happened.
Yes.
And she was blessing us and warning us not to do that. So for years thereafter, I would read that letter at our family's Passover celebrations. My father had never talked about her. I think he felt so guilty. You know, I think that's one way that he just had to deny and cut off his own guilt feelings. And I know it must have been incredibly painful for him. My mother tells a story that when the family was in Cuba trying to get into the United States, my father spent a night just weeping about his mother. And then she said he never wept again. She never saw that side of him again. Mm. It's like he just shut that door and closed it.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think one of the reasons that I needed to start my writing life on the mother line was that I was so haunted by it, and in ways that I wasn't conscious of until I began actually working on the book. And as I was working on the book, this letter came to me from my father's estate, and his mother revealed herself to me, and she's shown up in poetry, and she's got a chapter in my new book, The Sister from Below, which is a book about creativity. And, you know, she's like an inner figure who speaks to me in active imagination and with whom I need to kind of check things out, as is my maternal grandmother. I'm sitting in my study as I talk to you, and I'm looking at her self-portrait done in 1936, in a very, very bad time, which is a portrait. She was a very fine painter. It's a portrait of so much grief and so much suffering and so much strength that she can look at herself in the mirror and, you know, paint what she sees, paint the truth of her own suffering, of the shadow that she's living under.
Wow.
So you see, I come from a mother line of,
yeah,
of very passionate, intense women.
Right. And you've done them honor, I think, in your work and your journey.
Well, thank you.
You mentioned active imagination, and I, you know, that's something that I've been interested in, and actually did a couple of recent interviews about. Maybe you could,
yeah, I heard your interview with what's his name, the guy who writes
Raff.
About the Ally.
Yeah,
Jeffrey, that was nice. I like that.
Jeffrey Raff.
Yeah, Jeffrey Raff. Yes.
Yeah. Could you tell us a little bit about your use of active imagination?
Well, you know, that takes us beyond the mother line. I wasn't really doing it so much in the mother line, though the last chapter, it began to happen. I began to be assaulted by these figures, so I'll talk about that.
If we leave the mother line. That's okay. Okay, too.
Well, in the last chapter of the mother line, I tell this story of a trip that my second husband and I and my mother took to Germany, and then after, it was a very powerful trip because I met the people that my mother had grown up with who were wonderful people, and none of them Nazis. I mean, talk about fate, you know? Among American Jews, there's just been this hatred of anything German, and I grew up with that. And my mother, who went to a very progressive little school before she had to leave Germany, was approached by the people, by the non-Jews who were part of that school, and asked to come back to Germany because they missed her. So she had sort of broken through that anger, that Jewish anger at anything German, and realized that there were a lot of Germans who were very good people who had been caught in something that was way bigger than they. Mm-hmm. That's a little bit off the topic. Anyway, from there we went to England, which I had not thought of as goddess country, but we went to Glastonbury, and I had an experience sitting on the tour at Glastonbury, which is that famous tour that shows up in the stories about King Arthur, and used to be an island and was all part of the Arthurian romance. Sitting there, I suddenly saw this image that I actually found embarrassing. It was an old woman who was naked and who was just blatantly showing her vulva and sort of spreading the lips of her vulva and grinning.
Wow.
And I thought, my God, who is this? You know, and I thought, maybe she's Aztec, maybe she's Mayan. I've never seen anything like that before. And it was, you know, I sort of thought, I wanted to pull the curtain down over her.
Well, this reminds me of Jung's dream where, you know, feces is raining down from heaven on the church. And that was also
his vision, right?
An unbidden image that came to
exactly
him.
Exactly. And it opened everything up for him, but because once he allowed that image in, then he was able to question all of the conventions.
Yeah, so coming back to yours.
Yeah, which actually that's wonderful because, you know, that's sort of what happened with me. We walked down the tour, and I didn't say anything to my husband because I didn't know how to describe this outrageous image. And then we went to a little souvenir shop, and I picked up a little book about images in, goddess images or pagan images from the area, and opened it, and there, talk about synchronicity, was exactly the image of who I had seen
top
of the tour in my you know, with my eyes closed.
Wow.
It was Sheila Nagig. I don't know if you know Sheila Nagig, but Sheila Nagig is a very powerful goddess. She shows up, believe it or not, on churches, on old English and Irish churches. She'll be, you know, as you enter the church door, she'll be right above the church door. And she has a kind of Kali-like presence in the pagan religion of you know, because England, of course, was pagan before it was Christian, of that area. And she carries both the sense of birth and death, very much the way that Kali does.
Mm-hmm.
And so my, you know, kind of letting her in and writing about her and letting her lead me to an understanding of the dark aspects of the feminine and how important they are, both about aging as a woman and about holding the tension between women's lives as having to do with birth and death. That was extremely important for me, and it led me on into really the courage, I think, to be able to listen to inner voices and pay attention to inner images that everything in the culture would say, put that away, that's yucky, or that's nonsense, or that's silly, or don't listen to that.
Or that's crazy, right?
Or that's crazy, exactly.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
I'm just really interested in the mechanics for the sake of my listeners. Is that something then that you dialogue with this goddess in your journey, in your journal, or?
Well, what happened with her is I saw her and I wrote down about her. But then as I, you know, began understanding what Jung meant by active imagination and reading his work about it, which was enormously helpful to me, and began paying more attention to dream figures as they showed up or little glimpses of things when I, you know, would sit and meditate a little bit, I've developed a technique for working with it that works for me, and I think everybody has a different way of doing this. But my way, and it's something that I talk about in my new book, The Sister from Below, which is When the Muse Gets Her Way, because the sister from below was the one who showed up and announced that it was her time, and I was to listen to her and stop, you know, paying so much attention to the outer world and pay more attention to the inner world, mm-hmm. because it was time for me to be a poet again. So what I do is I sit and I allow the image to come up, and then I just ask her what she has to say to me, and I write in her voice. And I'm always totally astounded by what she has to say, which is not usually something that I was thinking about mm-hmm. or was conscious of.
Yes.
So she'll bring this deeper wisdom. She'll bring something from the archetypal realm that I don't have access to from the point of view of my ego or from the point of view of the culture.
Right. I wonder if this relates at all to the final chapter of your book, which is titled The Forbidden Feminine. And so,
yeah, that's exactly who, that's the forbidden yeah. feminine, of course, is Shelynda Gigg. I mean, that's how I got
mm-hmm.
there.
Mm-hmm.
It was through Shelynda Gigg. But I'll tell you, the sister from below, who's my muse, is also pretty scary. She's pretty forbidden.
What can you tell us about her?
Well, she doesn't give a hang, you know, if I get dinner on the table for the kids or if I pay the mortgage. She just wants poetry, and she'll take over. And I actually believe that it took me two long Jungian analyses to be able to get a strong enough ego connection to myself and to what needed to happen in the real world to be able to tolerate her enormous energy, because she just comes racing through me, and she, you know, she's like Dionysian energy. She'll just as soon rip you apart as look at you. But if you have a strong enough container, then it's enormously exciting to allow that to come up, and you say, okay, I give you an hour, I'm going to write for an hour, and then I'm going to work. Goodbye.
And so does poetry come out as a result in those
sessions?
That's
right. That's how poetry comes out.
And you've published some books of poetry now, right?
I do. I have three books of poetry and a couple more on the way.
Is there a poem that you would like to share with us?
Oh, well, let's see. You know, I'm going to read you a poem that I put in The Sister from Below that is an expression of the kind of wildness of this energy, and also how dangerous and how exciting it is. And it's a poem that came out of a bunch of out of dreams, and it's called "The Woman You're Not." The woman you're not is sure of her great-breasted body, mermaid to this one, siren to that. She knows where to put her feet, knows each step of the dance, and her voice from the deep of her belly, how she flings it about like her long, fiery hair, her laugh that collides with the stars. Fear never touches her, whose dreams rise up like sap, and any man who knows her teeth and the back of her hand. She grows crystals at the bottom of your garden, wears purple silk and lavender chiffon, travels in a green and yellow covered wagon drawn by seven giraffes. This morning, in a dream, she's handed you an image under glass, a bale of hay in a field of darkness, burning.
That's beautiful. And,
thank you.
And that's not only the woman you are not, but it's also the woman you are. Right?
Well, she's an archetype. You can have moments of her, but if you let yourself be taken over, you know, there goes everything.
Oh, really? So there's some danger there.
Oh, a lot of danger. I mean, she, you know, she's nasty. She's a bitch on wheels, and she's also enormously creative. You know?
Well, as we wind down here, I wonder if there's anything that you'd like to add, anything that you maybe didn't get to say, or any thought that you'd like to leave our listeners with.
Well, it's just I've enjoyed talking to you a lot, and I appreciate what you have said about the male point of view about all of this. I think that's been it's been very important. And I guess the thing that happened for me with the sister from below, I'd like to add this, is that my muse appeared to me, and she shapeshifted in all different forms. She was a sister from below, and she turned into my the grandmother I told you about, who died just at the time that I was conceived. But by the end of the book, she had shapeshifted into a male. And I always thought the muse was female, you know, and she is in many ways. But for me, she also was a male figure who was somebody that I had known when I was young, who's no longer on this planet. And I found that very meaningful. It felt like a conjunctio, to use the Jungian word, the Latin Jungian word about the marriage of opposites and the marriage of the male and the female, that there needed to be a coming together of male and female, both externally and internally. And that seems really important to me.
Yes, that's lovely. Thanks for sharing that with us. Dr. Naomi Ruth Lewinsky, thanks for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you.
Okay, well, I do hope you enjoyed this conversation with Jungian analyst Dr. Naomi Ruth Lewinsky. You heard my surprise that her book, The Mother Line, Every Woman's Journey to Find Her Female Roots, was first published 20 years ago. However, Jung's timeless books were published much further back than that, and her book is a timeless one. I'll be sure to put an Amazon.com link to it in the show notes for easy purchase. You also might want to consider a more recent book that she mentioned, which is The Sister from Below, When the Muse Gets Her Way. I believe that book goes into greater detail about the encounter with the archetypal Kali-type figure she shared with us, which unleashed her poetic creativity. Especially for those of you interested in active imagination, I think that book will give you an even more detailed sense of how she approached that work. You can also find two books of her poetry on Amazon. One title is Red Clay is Talking, and the other is provocatively titled Crimes of the Dreamer.
I've been laying on this couch, babe. I've been laying here so long, just waiting for Dr. Dave, babe, to play his shrink wrap radio song. Oh, he plays it so sweet and it plays it so warm. Shrink wrap radio, it's a harbor from the storm. You know he speaks to your mind, babe, but he's really speaking to your soul. Talking shrink wrap radio, babe. You know that's just the way that he rolls. At the end of the day, you know what you'll find. Like Dr. Dave said, it's all in your mind.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. And for first-time listeners, welcome for the first time. I'm glad that you've discovered us. I've got great news to announce here that we have a second supporter at the super colossal level. You'll recall that our first super colossal donor was Katie Morrison of Morrison Mentoring in Melbourne, Australia. And now we have a second super colossal donor at $30 a month for 12 months, and that's Peter Myron. So thank you so much, Katie and Peter. I want to again announce the availability of our apps for the iPhone and for Android devices, actually iOS devices generally and Android devices. Please consider purchasing these apps for iPhone and Android. And there are instructions on our website for doing so under the apps tab at the top of the page. The iPhone app utilizes something called Podcast Box, and that's all explained on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. That app, podcast app, got updated, and when it got updated, it no longer worked on my iPhone 4S, and it took me a long time to figure out how to get it working. So one tip is that after you download the app, instead of searching for Shrink Wrap Radio on the app, as the instructions said before. What you need to do is you'll notice there is a tab at the bottom of the iPhone screen that says Categories. And you need to go to the Science and Medicine category and then choose Shrink Wrap Radio from the shows that are mentioned there. And then it should work fine for you. So be sure to go to the app section. And if you have a smartphone, hey, it's very convenient once you have this app on your phone. I love it. My son loves it. I haven't heard from anybody on the Android side yet, so please, if you're using it on your Android device or if you've tried to use it and can't use it, please give me some feedback. I need to know what's going on there. In other news, I'm happy to announce that we have 5 new transcripts on the site. I think it's 5. I know we have a whole raft of them. First of all, I want to give my thanks to Katie Morrison. As if being our first super colossal donor were not enough, she's gone ahead and transcribed number 287 on e-psychotherapy with Dr. Ofer Zur. Thanks also to Renata Sylecki for transcribing number 109 on War and the Soul with Dr. Edward Tick. I'm really glad to have that one transcribed because I think that stands out in my mind as one of my all-time favorites among many others. And Renata also transcribed number 263 on an intuitive approach to treating trauma with Dr. Sage Breslin. Dale Hoff transcribed number 4 on the death of psychology with Jerry Trumbull. Number 5, in which I'm interviewed about podcasting, psychology, and my serial killer book on the Zodiac serial killer. And number 7 on Mayan Shamanic Healing with Norbert Muig. So thanks very much to Dale Hoff for doing 3 transcripts in very short order. And I now realize that that is 6 transcripts rather than the 5 that I originally stated. And you can, of course, find all of these transcripts on the transcripts page. There is a tab at the top of the Shrink Wrap Radio site that says transcripts, and that's where you find them. Oh, I just realized I forgot to mention something while I was talking about the podcast apps. I heard from a listener in the Netherlands that he was enjoying using the iPhone app, and that came as a surprise to me because I thought I had been told that people in other countries would not be able to use the app. So if you're able to go onto the App Store, the iTunes App Store, and find Podcast Box, if that shows up for you, then you should be able to use the iPhone app in whatever country you're in, and you should be able to use it not only on the iPhone, but also on the iPod Touch and the iPad, any iOS device. I was recently interviewed for more than 2 hours on the topic of a Jungian approach to dreams by Swedish listener and podcast host of the podcast Open Questions, Irina Almgren. And she did a very good job of interviewing me and drawing me out. And she has broken that interview into 3 separate podcasts. Right now, only 2 of them are up, and the 3rd, she tells me, will be going up pretty soon. So if you'd like to hear me hold forth on dreaming, you'll definitely want to listen to her podcast interviews with me. I've put a link to them on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. There is a tab that is titled In the Media. So if you click on In the Media tab, you can find your way to those interviews. I also suggested to Irina that she look into whether or not it might be possible to set up a workshop for me on dreams, either a weekend workshop or maybe a 5-day workshop, to kind of check around and see if there might be people who would be interested in paying something to attend such a workshop. I would love to visit Sweden and to have a good reason to go there. Or any other place in the world, if one of you listeners wants to try to put something like that together, have dreams will travel. Let me remind you that we have an Amazon.com link in the right-hand sidebar on our website, and please use that link for anything that you're ordering from Amazon, and we will get a trickle of money as a result of your doing that, whether it's books or electronics or anything else that you might be purchasing from Amazon. Also, if there are any professionals who are perhaps listening to this podcast for the first time, I want to make you aware that you can get CE units, continuing education units, just for listening to selected Shrink Wrap Radio podcasts. And you'll find information about that on the site. The pricing is very, very reasonable. And finally, I want to thank everyone who's clicked on that big green donate button on our homepage. Your one-time and ongoing donations help to keep my fire burning. And it's still the case that a relatively small number of people are helping to support this series. There's a lot of work that goes into it. So won't you please add your name to the honor roll of those who either periodically or on a one-time basis or monthly basis make contributions. And you'll feel really good about exercising your generosity muscles. We know that's a strong contributor to happiness. So just go to our homepage at Shrink Wrap Radio and click on the big green donate button, and I thank you.
Hi, this is Jungian analyst Tom Elsner, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thanks, Dr. Tom Elsner, who will be my guest on the next episode. More about that in a bit. First, let's listen to a few recent emails from our Shrink Wrap Radio listener community. First, we hear from Dale, who just sent us not one, not two, but three transcripts. Dale writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I'm writing to express my appreciation for the service you are providing for your interviewees and for your listeners. I've thoroughly enjoyed every program I've heard. To express my appreciation, I'm attaching three transcripts I did for shows number 3, number 5, and number 7. They're in MS Word 2007 format. On a personal note, I wonder how frequently the engineering to psychology switch occurs. I would like to," and he's referring to, I think, the fact that I've mentioned that I made that switch some years back. He goes on to say, "I would like to mention that, like you and several of your guests, I switched from engineering, electrical, then mechanical, to psychology, a BS from Arizona State University, due to a sort of disillusionment and disenchantment with what I perceived as the prevailing mechanistic objectivism of the time, in the 80s and 90s. I recall that as a child, I sat for hours trying to bend a spoon with my mind after having read some book with instructions for doing so. I failed completely, but I well remember the sense of awe and the feeling of absolute certainty that I should at least entertain the idea that such a thing can and should be possible. Over time, and due to repeated failures in my exploration, I lost that viewpoint and came to accept that the only things that were real were objectively sensible and measurable. However, more recent experiences have led me back to the sense that, quotes, there are more things on heaven and earth, end quote. And sometimes those revolutions are trying due to their intensity, especially when you don't have any like-minded people relating similar experiences and questioning the nature of that experience. And you just don't find too many shows on Spike TV where people are discussing their personal epistemological journey and relating it directly to their own concrete experience. I therefore appreciate the venue that you provide to the stellar cast of people who have interesting and fascinating personal worldviews and discoveries that they are willing to share with the rest of us. Thank you." And that's from Dale Hoff. And Dale, thanks so much for that feedback. And it's, yeah, you know, I have a fair number of technical people who either are engineers or who have left engineering who are listeners to this show. So there's some kind of thread going on there, maybe one that I don't completely understand. But I sure appreciate your transcribing those three shows. That was a real gift. Thanks so much. Next, we hear from Peter Myron, our second super colossal donor, who I mentioned earlier, and he writes in response to my thanks, "Hi, David. I've been wanting for some time to increase my support level, and then recently I noticed that my previous subscription of $10 a month had expired in September. I'm so happy to lend you my support, and as you once joked, you deserve a raise for high-quality service you provide. So here is a small piece of that raise. Your shows, Wise Counsel 2, is one of the bright points in my life. I have learned so much from your guests over the 3 years that I've been a listener. My contribution hardly pays you back for my gain. I have written you before explaining I'm in individual and group therapy. I feel your show directly supports and encourages my personal growth process in a number of ways. In particular, I see that it enhances what the Buddhists call right view. Very often I'm inspired to learn about a therapy or an idea discussed by you and a guest, and I'm off on another journey of discovery, all of which helps me develop a healthy perspective and a more comprehensive view of my own self and process. I would love to hear more shows on marriage counseling or perhaps personal growth with the context of a primary relationship. Two people I would encourage that you check out are Bruce Tift, who's just come out with an excellent book, Already Free, Buddhism Meets Psychotherapy. Oh, that sounds interesting. And David Schnarch, author of Passionate Marriage. And then he provides links to both of those. On a personal note, spending as much time with you as I do, hours of dog walking time each week, I feel as though I can consider you a personal friend. Your warmth and humanity shines through each episode. I have a Sebastopol, California connection. My brother and sister-in-law live on the outskirts, so I nurture a private fantasy of meeting you for a coffee some visit. I don't know about an on-show shout-out for me, part of what I offered for the super colossal donor. He goes on to say, but I'm going to explore the possibility of you mentioning a men's organization I belong to in Chicago. It's a wonderful organization that offers personal growth weekends, weekend programs, and fosters the establishment of small men's group circles. I've been a thriving member for 5+ years and see the great good it does enriching men's lives. In the interest of due diligence, I feel the need to clear this with the organization first. Please keep up the good work, David. Your friend, Pete. Pete, again, thanks so much for being a colossal donor, and I would love to meet with you over coffee if you ever make it out here to Sebastopol, and I'll look into getting one or both of the guests that you mentioned. And as you may know, I've been a member of a men's group myself for probably close to 20 years, so I really applaud that, and I would be happy to mention that organization if you pass that info along to me. And by the way, I did have Pete's permission to read this email on the air. Next, we hear from longtime listener Rick V, who writes, I just thought I would drop you a line and let you know that grad school is kicking my ass, but I couldn't imagine doing anything else. Thanks for being an important piece in my puzzle. Hope you are well, my friend. And that's from Rick. And Rick has been a longtime listener and a frequent contributor to the show. He's posted in the comments area extensively before he got so busy in graduate school. So it's great to get this progress report from you, Rick, and hang in there. Next, here's one from Susanna from Down Under, who writes, Hi, Dr. Dave. I'm a psychotherapist in Sydney, and I've just discovered your podcast. Thank you so much for these. It's just fantastic to go for a walk and listen to such interesting conversations. Just a thought, have you ever interviewed Dr. Stephen Gilligan? I'm sure I'm not the first to put his name forward, but having done many of his trainings, I think he could be a fabulous guest for you. Also, Michael Yapko, Bill O'Hanlon, Ernest Rossi, Jeff Zeig, all the Ericksonians. In their own way, they are all carrying on the work of Milton, and have each developed their own niches. Just a thought. Many thanks for your work. I will let others here in my therapeutic community know about you. Best wishes. And that's from Susanna. Susanna, it's great to have you as a new listener, and do keep listening. And I have interviewed Bill O'Hanlon. I've got a video or two of Dr. Stephen Gilligan, and he would, in fact, make a great guest. I have a feeling that I tried inviting him in the past, but I'm not certain. He may have turned me down. I'm not sure. A good friend of mine was in treatment with Ernie Rossi for a long time. And certainly I've heard of Jeff Zeig. So you've really given me quite a shopping list here. We'll see what we can do. Just stay tuned. Finally, here is a gratifying message from Tracy, who writes, "Hello, Dr. Dave. I do not know how many times I've meant to contact you to tell you how much I enjoy your podcast. You are simply the most gentle and humble yet thorough interviewer. I appreciate how you bring your own views into the podcast without taking on an argumentative stance. That is difficult to do, I know. I really appreciate the quality of the individuals on your show. It's clear that the podcast is a work of love, and I want you to know that yet another listener feels her life enriched by your show. I'm an industrial/organizational psychologist who has just retired from a faculty position of 27 years at Chico State. I know you're familiar with my university since you are or were, I believe, with Sonoma State. I'm so glad to leave that world. I have recently started volunteering for the Happiness Initiative, and she gives the URL as www.happycounts.org, and it's an interesting URL worth checking out. She goes on to say, the volunteer work is so meaningful, and so many of your podcasts touch on just the variables we measure as leading to happiness. I think you will find the website interesting. I just came aboard on the initiative, so I'm still learning. It would be great to interview someone from the initiative, but that person would not be me. If you are interested, I can set up the contact for you. I've just written this sentence while proofing my email before sending, so getting the initiative on the podcast is not my intention here. What I would like you to know is that we have been providing links to some of your podcasts on both Facebook and then on their site at www.happycounts.org and Twitter. I wanted you to know that your name and podcasts are getting press in ways that you are not aware. That makes me very happy. I write some of the synopses, in fact, all of those relating to your show. Please forgive me if I have not hit precisely on the points made in the show. I'm quite restricted by word count. I've also turned on many friends to your podcast. Podcasts have opened a whole new world of knowledge for me. I started listening a couple of years ago and am hooked. My new home is Portland, and true to form in this city, I do not own a TV. I've been watching a series on TV called Portlandia that kind of pokes fun at the Portland ethic. She concludes, you seem such a kind person. Thank you for your generosity. And that's from Tracy McDonald. Tracy, so glad to have you on as a new listener, and thank you for all your efforts to help get the word out. I fully encourage you to keep it up, and do let me know if there's someone at the Happy Initiative there that you're working with that would make a good guest to interview. So I think that better wrap it up for today. As always, send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. And if you get the Shrink Wrap Radio app on your iPhone or your Android phone, there's a facility right there to leave voice messages or to send email. So thanks again to Jungian analyst Dr. Naomi Ruth Lewinsky for sharing her insights on the mother line. And my next episode will feature an interview with yet another Jungian, Dr. Tom Elsner, and we'll be speaking about his work with fairy tales. He comes strongly recommended by Monica Wickman, who I've had on the show twice, so I can promise you this will be another good one, especially if you're interested in Jungian stuff. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.